Go.
Recording.
Me too.
Hello and welcome to Our Dads Died, with me, Tom.
And me, Rich.
This is the podcast of people whose dads are dead.
It certainly is, because our dads are dead.
And your dads are dead or alive. Your mum might be dead, etc. We've done this every time. If someone you like is dead, this is the podcast for you.
You know the drill by now. We've got a fantastic guest this week, the brilliant Stuart Laws, comedian, writer, director. You might have seen him, you might have heard him even on the Off Menu podcast quite recently. He's very, very funny. Also, crucially, dead dad.
Dead dad.
And he discusses his show, Is That Guy Still Going? By Stuart Laws, which will soon, I believe, be available to view online. It's currently touring it. It's a fantastic show. He gets quite into the nitty-gritty of how he discussed his dad in that show and how that sort of, or the mechanics of all of that. So if you're a big comedy nerd like myself, it's a really fascinating listen. If you're a big dead dad nerd, it's also great from that point of view. A lot of juice
great follow-up
in this one.
Pop on his website, Stuart Laws' website. Go into Google, you'll be able to find it. And I'm not going to give you a URL. No, but you know what I mean. Oh, I'll find the URL and read it out letter by letter. Put his name, as it sounds, into your phone and his website will come up. You know?
That's just the worst plug I've ever heard. Go to his website, Stuart Laws, I don't know, on Google.
Just, why not? Why wouldn't you, though? That's the easiest way to find his website and all
the
social
way.
Media stuff. But that's it. Or Bing. No, use Bing. Use Bing. Oh, you know, want to be balanced. Use Bing, for God's sake. You duck, duck, go. Find his website. Find his tour dates. Go see him. He's a funny guy.
Right, well, here's our interview with StuartLaws.com. Stuart, we've never had to ask this question on this podcast before, but I feel like having watched your show, Is That Guy Still Going? I feel like we should begin by clarifying, because you do, and I hope this isn't rude of me to say, you do tell a lot of lies on stage.
Yes.
You're a big liar.
Yeah.
So, just to be clear, is your dad dead?
Yeah, he did.
He's dead.
Yeah, he did.
Is dead. He is dead. Okay, good.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing from it. Ivo Graham came to see it in Edinburgh, and he was like, you know, loved the show, but I do, there's a part of me that doubts that your dad is dead.
Really?
As you go, that's a bold move.
Yeah.
And there was a time when I wanted to do the show. The show took... I'd say 5 years of like writing and rewriting, and I did other shows in the in-between because it didn't quite come together. It wasn't coming together how I wanted to do it. And one of the ideas was that there would be a stooge throughout who turns out to be my partner. And she reveals at the end that I don't even have, my dad is still alive.
Right.
And that I had done a dead dad show, but with an alive dad.
Yeah, that would be a very Stuart Laws move, because on top of that, you've also got
he is actually dead.
I mean, it's a brilliant show. It's really funny, and it's a great approach to the whole dead dad Edinburgh show. But I was obviously almost 100% sure that your dad was dead, but there was just a moment right at the end that was like, oh, is this? And there's still part of me that's like, get to the end of this and be like, oh, no, here he is.
No, it's actually, what year are we now in? So it's like 9 years ago now, sort of quite recent.
Right, okay.
That it passed. And it sort of took that long to sort of fathom fully how I wanted to do it, because I knew that there was that trope of, you know, dead dad shows.
Mm-hmm.
In Edinburgh, in stand-up, but also this sort of like weaponizing of grief in general in art that I sort of don't fully back. I'm not like fully on board with that unless there is like a purpose for it. I think grief and sadness and that for the sake of it, just to sort of create a deeper emotional bond, just seems sort of hollow and manipulative in a way. And I was like, I don't really want to talk about this unless I have something to contribute to it, that like a different spin on it, and that was where the concept of long grief came about. Because I don't know about, I think the same for you guys is that you can joke about anything to do with, you know, your dead dad at any point, but suddenly randomly just something will trigger like an emotional response, and you just don't even know what it is, and you suddenly feel this sort of like overwhelming sense of like loss and grief and all of that, where you're just like, I was completely cold to it 10 minutes ago, and now suddenly something has changed that. And that to me was an interesting concept of this thing that won't ever leave you, and will just be so unpredictable that you just sort of have to live with, especially if, you know, you lost your, you know, father or your mother, or, you know, a partner or a loved one at an unexpected time. It wasn't unexpected for my dad. He was an alcoholic, but like he was too young really to die.
Yeah. It's funny. It's the, like you were saying there, the sort of the different things that will completely out of the blue affect you. Sometimes it's the exact same thing that you've talked about, or something that's happened before, or a song that you've listened to hundreds of times, and then suddenly you hear it one time, you're like, oh no, this time it's going to cause quite a large emotional tidal wave to crash in my head for some reason. It is completely unpredictable. So your dad died 9 years ago, and he was, how old was he at the time?
So that would put him at 68, maybe, something like that.
Yeah, so quite young.
Yeah. But I'd say, Or to be 68 that year, so like, 67 maybe.
Was it something that was expected at that time, or?
Oh, he was making a good fist of trying to die for a while.
Right.
Yeah, that motherfucker was trying to get going.
He'd been heading out for some time.
Yeah, he made a real solid fist of it 5 years previous. Four and a half years previous, where it sort of had bled out of the throat, because obviously when you're alcoholic, your veins and arteries sort of thin massively, and had sort of, I think it's a common thing with alcoholics that then if you have some sort of like violent like vomiting fit or something like that brought along, I don't understand fully how it, but it can cause those things to rupture. And you then sort of bleed to death
from the throat.
And from the throat, pretty horrendous stuff.
Yeah.
But they managed to, so he was in intensive care then for like, I want to say a few months. And they managed to eventually, like he would have died on the operating table and in A&E actually. And they were trying desperately to stem the bleeding, and it was, they're putting in stents and all of that sort of stuff that weren't able to stop it. So eventually managed to stop it, managed to clot it, and then he then survived another sort of 4.5 years. It's like a pretty reduced sort of version of himself, I guess.
Wow, that was a pretty solid fist of finding a way out.
Yeah,
I wasn't expecting bleeding from the throat, I'll be honest.
You weren't?
I wasn't
ready for that.
I was just, it, when you started saying bleeding, I wasn't expecting the throat, I'll be honest.
You were thinking butt, weren't you?
I was hoping butt. Certainly. Yeah. That's where you want it to be. Penis, I obviously also hilarious, but throat, that's quite a it's a graphic image, isn't it?
It is particularly graphic. I'm sorry if that's...
No, that's what we're here for.
Yeah, I'm putting no trigger warnings or like content warnings at the front of any of this. I'm assuming if you're listening to a Dead Dad's podcast, there's a part of you that's steeled for bleakness.
You have to at the very least expect that some form of death is going to happen at some point.
Certainly, yeah.
Although having seen your stand-up, I guess, or not, it's sort of unclear.
Whether or not he's still alive.
Yeah, it might be. It's a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little bit like that.
So how, I was about to say, how was the experience for you? How was losing your dad?
How was the experience? It's good times now.
It's an interesting one when it happens over a period of time that you sort of get inured to it, to a certain extent. And certainly by the end, you're like, well, this is what they sort of want. So, you know, they're achieving that goal is sort of getting them free from, you know, a lot of the pain and the difficulty that they're going through. So there's a part of you that is like, you know, logically, you're just like, I mean, I think this is a good thing. But from and as I made sort of clear in the show, it's interesting actually doing the show at the moment. I'm on tour with it. Is that I've gone through to the original script again, and what happens in Edinburgh is you sort of drift further away from it as you add new jokes, you sort of get the rhythms of it different. And I've realized I wanted to retweak some of it back to the original script because it was sort of making a little clearer the point of some of the bits that I talk about in the grief section at the end of the show. But to do with the fact that initially I definitely didn't really feel much early on. And it's sort of, especially sort of like the first 10 hours after it happened was like just literally business, going to like the nearby, you know, offices where you have to register the death. You know, I've got a sister and two half sisters, and we were all involved at, you know, in that sort of process, and we're all there when he died. But in that exact moment, it didn't sort of really hit me in any sort of noticeable way. Yeah. And I'm not sure fully whether that is just literally that's me as a person. I am also autistic, and there's a thing called alexithymia or alexithymia that is associated with that, which is a reduced sort of ability to know how you're feeling or whether or not you even should be feeling any sort of emotions, which is a little fun thing to sort of ride alongside and be like, is that or is this just how I am about this sort of thing?
Yeah.
Or is it grief? Or is that how grief works?
Yeah, that's interesting. I can only speak from my experience and Tom's experience to an extent, though you're probably better at speaking from your experience than I am. but that seems quite common. It's such a massive lot of emotions to have all at once. I think it's quite normal for your body to go, well, we'll just feel none of it for now, and then we'll deal with that further down the line. I mean, Tom, I don't think you've actually had an emotion since your dad died.
No. It's been an emotionless, I was trying to think what the opposite of a roller coaster is, really. Queue. It's been an emotionless queue. just waiting for when the emotional roller coaster will come. But it's just the queue, it is endless. Every now and again, there's a little performer. And then you go, oh, yeah, that's what an emotion's like. But it doesn't. It's fleeting. But I'm very recent still. He claims after 4.5 years have passed. Nonetheless, recent in my head. So it's difficult, really. I think it is quite hard to find an emotion at most times. But to be honest, I mean, this is a new one for the podcast, but I'm starting to wonder if actually I was a bit like this before. Actually, I was always just didn't really do emotions very much. And this is just how I just normally reacted. I only just became aware of it after I was like, oh no, you're meant to like be really sad, right? You do you do know that you're meant to be really sad because like your dad's gone forever.
But that's the difficulty of it, isn't it? Is how you feel versus how feel like you are expected to feel, and then I guess for yourself as well, like you were saying with having autism and then not knowing the way that you feel is the way that most people feel, and whether it's another thing altogether.
Which is a real fun little like additional extra feature of autism.
Yeah.
Where you go, is this my brain doing something different, or is it just...
Yeah, just constantly second-guessing your own emotions.
Yeah.
At a time when, I mean, it is weird that there's either sort of all the emotions or none of the emotions all in one go. They don't kind of parcel them out after a loss.
No, and it is an interesting thing on that. I do know that, like, I sort of had it all under control. And not even, like, I wasn't even struggling to have it under control. And then when I got home, my partner at the time, had been really supportive during it. I then sort of got back, and I did have a break then, and she was really great and comforted, and it was, you know, really useful. But it was sort of almost just like, it wasn't even for like the loss specifically. It was for the like the stress of the 10 years leading up to it almost. And just like, well, that's sort of done now. And I don't think I cried about it again, you know, probably for, you know, a year or so, or maybe even longer.
Yeah.
Including at the funeral. You know, it was just a literal like, right, that's done.
Yeah.
You know, I've done all the admin. Everything's complete. I'm home. I'm safe. Now it can, you know, break for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, I think, Tom, did you cry at your dad's funeral? I don't think I cried at my dad's funeral. I think
the man just dashed behind you.
Oh yeah, you there, sorry, I should have referenced
which was
that.
Quite funny.
Is that your dad?
Yeah. His ghost every now and again will pop up, pops into the
even
kitchen.
Even though he'd be an amazing guest for the podcast, but he's still like, oh, I don't want to bother you. You know,
that would be the ultimate coup. Imagine if we had the ability to get my dad on and we just decided not to. We've contacted his spirit, but
yeah,
there he goes.
But no, that's my brother who has also lost his dad because we had the same dad. So he's technically allowed. He is allowed to be on the podcast. He's just
he can be a guest.
Good. He's checking on a lentil curry in the background.
good stuff. Classic dad kind of fare. I don't remember what your question was. Was it?
Did you cry at your dad's funeral? Yeah, that was the one.
Nope. I don't think so. I did have a vague kind of emotional reaction, but I still think it was performative. I don't know. I mean, funerals are odd. Funerals are like a time when everyone goes, and this is where you're meant to do your grief.
Yes,
so
yeah, yeah.
Time for it, but you might just feel a bit like, well, it isn't a very good time for me. I think I could have a good go at his funeral now. I think I'm a bit in a better place to have a go at it. But I feel like at the time it was probably the wrong time for it.
I like the idea of you outside the you know, the funeral place, whatever they're called, the crematorium.
Yeah.
Is it a funeral parlor? Is that
funeral
correct?
Parlor?
Because it is close to ice cream parlor, so it sort of feels like it shouldn't be.
Get your hair done, get your ice cream, get your cremated dad done.
Yeah.
Just you outside, sort of like, you know, brushing your feet back like you're a bull, just sort of preparing to grieve. Let's get in there.
Getting psyched up.
Yeah.
A little team talk beforehand. Everyone in a huddle.
Yeah, yeah.
We go again. Oh, we do let this slip.
Yeah, yeah.
Let these tears slip.
But it is weird. Because it's the worst, also the worst time. Grief is quite a confusing and personal thing. And so to be told, right, on the 13th of January, we're all going to gather together in a church, none of us are religious, in a church together, and we're all going to weep openly in a way that every single one of us has tried our whole lives not to do. It's almost impossible to then process your emotions properly in that moment.
It's why I can't go to sex parties. It's like, I know I'm going to get my timing wrong.
Well, that's when you'll start grieving.
Yeah, I immediately start crying as soon as I'm presented with that much intensity.
It's the one way around. The opposite is worse, though. The opposite is worse. That is still the one way around. I'd like to ask about your show, if that's all right. I was entertained and amused and then completely blown away by the message that you had. I mean, what's going on in your head when you find a message?
Can I just clarify what you think, what the message is?
Yeah, I think that would be handy.
Get this very wrong, where I just go, yeah, the message is the Falklands is incredible.
the message, you know, that you found from your dad.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So that is. So there's a very slight bit of filmic adjustment to it to make it sort of give it a bigger ending. He did teach me beer mat flipping, and that is like was a big part of growing up, was, you know, learning beer mat flipping and doing that sort of repeatedly in like these working men's clubs and pubs. And yeah, sort of who knew, I only recently found out I'm autistic, by the way. So looking back and go, hyperfixation on a thing from a young age. Why did no one notice? But the album, so the show is based around finding a message from my dad years after he died. within the George Harrison Cloud Nine album. And that is legit the only thing I kept of his. We did throw away almost everything of his. And I feel like that is sort of an indictment of all of our lives, that we will get to a point where it's just like someone's job is to get rid of the majority of what we held dear, because that's literally only we hold that dear. And yeah, the Cloud Nine album I decided to keep because I just remembered listening to it loads when we were younger, and it being like the first time that I think I'd sort of appreciated grown-up music, where I was like, this feels like a proper grown-up band. And so kept hold of it. But I remember taking it from the care home, you know, getting in my car, going to register the death, and maybe it wasn't there. Maybe it was like the next day or something like that when we were cleaning it away. But anyway, the point is, went straight in the car and it just sat there until I got a new car, where I just like put it, you know, reach for it, put it in the CD player, then got a new car which didn't have a CD player, so took it inside. And that was where I did open it properly for the first time and look at it, pay attention to it. And written on the CD sleeve itself was the message. Which again is a very slight filmic adjustment of like something else he had written to me before on another note. So it was sort of like taking what was on the CD sleeve, which he absolutely was like, oh, someone will keep hold of this. He knew that someone would keep hold of it. So he wrote that message and another message that he had written. I think actually the problem is that I would say that the two messages were more egotistical or narcissistic than I have made them. I've sort of taken the edges off of it to make it a more comforting, nicer ending.
Right.
I'd say that my dad was an ego-driven man. And I mean, I say that as someone who performs stand-up comedy and demands an audience listens to him for an hour. So the apple has not fallen far from the tree. But in those, it was like he definitely saw himself as he was a very funny man, and a lot of people found him very funny, and he was like life and soul of the party often. And so I think he saw me doing stand-up as sort of like I'm doing the thing that he sort of always wanted to be able to do but never did. Right. And potentially a lot of that would have been down to like opportunity. Like he was from a very working class background, grew up in like Peckham, moved out to Slough, you know, probably had very few opportunities, for something like that. But it meant that he sort of like, he attributed my success as a comedian, as a person sometimes down to him and his ability to being funny, where you're like, there's other ways of framing that, you know, of just being like, hey, congrats on being a funny, personable person, Stuart. That's good. Rather than being like, you know, the thing that people like about you, you get that from me.
Yeah. Taking full credit for your career.
Yeah. Yeah. So I toned down some of the phrasing that sort of like positioned him more centrally and sort of framed it slightly. What I did is I went, I think this is what you meant to say.
Yeah. Nice.
from a generous nicer point of view. Yeah. And I think from my perspective, I was like, you know, there is like complicated stuff as there is with any sort of person that's passed or any person that anyone's close with. But the story I was wanting to tell with the show was not his fully, like, I wanted to tell the truth about myself, but it doesn't mean I need to tell the truth about other people. So like the other people in the stories can be, you know, adjusted for the benefit of the message of the show. And the message of the show is sort of, of being more open, of tackling these things head on, of talking about them with people and making them a thing that can be discussed, can be joked about. It doesn't have to be like a dirty secret that you're, and that can apply to not just grief. It can apply to, you know, depression. It can apply to as I'm discovering now with autism, it can apply to, you know, to difficulties in relationships. And it's definitely something that I've found throughout my life is that I'm like, well, I don't want to burden other people with it, so I'm going to just keep it to myself. But the point is that will make it worse. And you turns out you've got a lot of people in your life that do want to be burdened. And yeah. It's, you know, it's not worth pretending it's not a burden, because, you know, to hear someone say very emotional, difficult things is difficult to encounter. But the more that you do it and you trust certain people in your life, the easier it is, and the better I think it is to deal with those things.
Yeah. It's a really good message. It's a really good point. It's something that I think I took a long time to learn, is that you, like you said, people want to help. And when you, when something's going on in your life and you tell people, it does, they're not going, oh, this fucking guy's banging on with his dad again. Jesus. It's been a year. Get over it. People are like, oh, I'm glad that you've spoken to me, because I was worried about you, and now I feel a bit better because I know what's going on.
And people like to feel wanted and appreciated and
helpful.
Like, and it, yeah, exactly. And I think the more that you like don't, the bigger the first time you talk about it becomes.
Yeah.
And so it becomes this thing where suddenly who you're speaking to finds it so much more difficult, because you're there being presented with not just, here's my thoughts on this thing that's recently happened. They're presented with 20 years of buildup and, you know, crushing stuff down and trying to deal with things yourself. And that is so much more difficult for someone to pass, to sort of provide anything useful and to come out of it feeling like, you know, fuck, I don't know how to deal with this. This person seems, you know, in a bad, bad way. And now I'm sort of roped in on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause then it's impossible to help them.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's sort of why, like, I sort of, you know, smoothed the edges off on the story, because it was like the message of the show was what made me want to do it. And then to, in and of that self, be more open and honest about how I personally feel on these things. And I do have a slight issue with like revealing too much about other people. And I think that's a thing that artists, which stand-up comedians definitely are, any sort of like storyteller, any sort of, you know, there's like, can be sort of a callousness sometimes of like, I have a story to tell and I'm going to get it out there and it doesn't matter who gets hurt by it. I think that there is like a duty of care on that side of things, and to sort of be, you know, to protect people, or to sort of like realize what the story you're telling and how that can affect other people.
That's really interesting, because the listeners to this podcast will have realized at some point that we do make these sorts of self-editing decisions when talking about our siblings or other family members. But I have to say, my dad / mum really do not get much luck on those fronts. And my mum's alive, but she does get slagged off seemingly every episode.
She specifically asked you to stop as well.
She deserves it. That's the thing about it that makes it so interesting. We do the honest stuff about the dad, though. We go maybe too honest at times about the dads.
It's interesting, because there is an element of just like, well, they aren't here now. And there's a line in my show which, when my mum sees it, my mum hasn't seen it yet. There's a part of me that thinks I might change that specific line, because it's about something she said to me, which was said with all kindness and, you know, nice intent, but it is a laugh line in the show. And a part of me was like, why don't I just give that to my dad? He can't fucking stand up for himself, can he? He's not going to come and see it and be offended by that.
That's fair. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no real need to protect them anymore. Yeah. How much more damage can you do?
He can be the one to say, you can't be autistic if you've got too much empathy. That's fine for my dad to say. He seems like the sort of person who'd say that. Yeah, he was born in 1947.
In keeping with his character. It's perfect.
There was something you said earlier about getting your dad's stuff and, yeah, only keeping a couple of bits, which is, you know, is quite a real point you made, and certainly we did it with my dad. I was wondering, of the things you have of your life, what would be the things that you would want people to keep? What are the sort of possessions where you would think, well, you know, and this can be that this is the actual, this is official, you know, we'll put this down, we'll write to HMRC. I don't know why they're the people who control this.
It was going to be my tax returns.
We'll get this in the books. Great. We'll get this in the books. So it's on a legal document somewhere. So they know. What's that thing that you've got that you would be like, well, all right, keep that.
Wow.
You know, what would that be?
After it's so difficult to really work it out. I mean, I know that like my friends, Matt and Hannah, they are first in line to get my TV. They always get my hand-me-down TV and they were around the other day. They love it. They're like, I'm always buying basically every 4 years whenever a new football tournament comes along that I'm like, now I need 4K.
Yeah.
Now I need HDR, so on and so on. They're like, okay, fine, here we go. So they get the next one down in line, and then my mum and her husband get the one after that in line.
Right. So there's a real conveyor belt of people waiting on TV after TV.
I've never heard of this before, the hand-me-down TV system. It's the classic hand-me-down mobile phone through the children, isn't it? The old brother gets, and then it goes down to the younger brother, and then it gets, sort of, the phone goes down the line. But with televisions, that does feel... I mean, these things are still valuable. You know, you can sell them. That they retain a lot of value. It's quite a significant gift you're giving people.
2010 was my first HD television for the World Cup in 2010. What a thrilling moment.
Sofia Weishabalala, yeah.
And then 2014, a new one. And then I think it did take to the 2021 Euros to get this latest one. So there was a bit more of a break on that one. And this one is proper solid. So I don't think that's going to pass down for at least, I'm going to say, at least another 4 years.
Yeah. 4 years. No time at all.
Another tournament.
That's 7 years on a TV. Seven years.
So you're going to discover QLED technology and you're just going to be like, get this out of my living room. This is useless. The blacks aren't even black.
My poverty-stricken friends, Matt and Hannah, they will have my hand-me-down 4K.
Yeah, give them my useless rubbish. Wonderful. So is it the TV? That feels like the
I'm trying to think, like, I can't think of any... But the problem is that everything I've created, right, that so I feel like the thing that you'd want to keep around would be something that you've created, and all of that is, like, a digital file.
Yeah. But then can be played on a state-of-the-art TV. So
that's true. Yeah.
There's that.
So it'll be the 4K special recording of this particular show, which I'm doing in June.
Perfect.
Whatever that is.
That's a pretty solid legacy to leave behind. I mean, it's going to be devastating for Matt and Hannah if you do eventually die, because then the run of new TV stops.
Oh, my God.
It's cut off at the source.
This is the thing, because grief is going to hit them so hard.
Yeah.
When they are trying to watch Apple TV Plus with HDR 4K turned on.
And at this point, they've just got a house full of TVs. There's just so many.
Surrounded by
everywhere. All these hand-me-down tellies just loaded up. A different stand-up special of yours on each one.
In the horrible standard dynamic range.
Yeah. And I mean, it's still like fairly good quality, the latest TV, but they know that as soon as there's some kind of new development, that grief's going to really hit them. Because that'll be the moment where they go, he's really gone.
He's really gone. We cannot see clearly in the shadows in this picture. Whereas if we had that new TV.
if only Stuart was still here. It's a great legacy to leave. It's also...
Thank you, yeah.
I mean, it's a good question to have an answer to, because when you were asking that, Tom, I was like, I have no idea what would be... I guess you don't really get to choose, do you? Like, the stuff that I've got from my dad wasn't the stuff that he would have handed on to me. It's the stuff
My dad gave me loads of junk. He gave me so much stuff. I'm telling you now, you do get to choose. He chose. He was like, here's a box full of stuff I've earmarked for you. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again. It bears repeating. Many of those things were drawings I'd done as a child. He was just like, well, I don't need these anymore, motherfucker. You take them back. They aren't coming with me.
Was this when he was dying?
Crazy. No, after he died. Well, before pre-death, he did like a box for each of his children and put into it. I actually don't know if my brother and sister... I know that boxes were there, but I don't know if there was really anything in them. Maybe I'm the only one that had anything good in. The rest was just sort of like a lump of coal or something.
It'd be great if they got your drawings as well. He was so proud of those drawings that you gave them to everyone.
Absolute chaos. But you can choose. I mean, this is what I'm saying, is that he chose a bunch of things to divide between the children. And then subsequently there were some extra items he didn't choose but did come my way. So I mean, you do have a choice, you know. You can get a box, pop a couple tallies in there.
Would you have a burn box where it's like you've got a box where you just go, I think I'm gonna pass away soon. I haven't got time to throw it all out, but I'm gonna put a few things in here which I'm just asking for no one to look in ever. Just put it in a fire.
I see. Oh. As in just like a sealed box that you hand to someone you trust and say,
yeah,
this needs
deal
to
with
be
this, please.
Destroyed
yeah.
without any eyes ever being upon it.
Yeah. And if it burns with a blue flame, just know that's all petroleum-based lubricant.
And just know. Why are you at that point saying don't open the box? You're saying that.
Look, they've said, yes, I'll do that, but you got to give me a little clue about what's in there.
Yeah,
and then you just say,
something.
It's so much lube.
Yeah,
I thought
yeah.
I would be more of a lube guy than I am.
So I invested in a vat and turns out.
Well, what, you can't take it to CEX, can you? Although, having said that, you can take TVs to CEX, but that's an irrelevancy in your life.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe Matt and Hannah could benefit from a huge gallon of lube.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I'll send them a text after this and be like, what do you want to do with all the lube?
They could smear it on the screen to make it soft focus. That'd be lovely.
I like the burn box, but I did mishear it as burn book. And then I'm sort of thinking this sort of, you've seen from the movie Mean Girls, popular in the 2000s, the book which contains all the information of all the people that they, all the mean things they write about people at school. And then I'm sort of thinking, oh, so I suppose, are you suggesting that when you die, you write all these horrible things about people and then give it to someone you love and go, that's
Ooh.
Where I keep all my hate. You can have that. But if you do open it, it's, you know, it's not great.
Yeah, that is stressful.
That'd be a brutal twist on what happened to you. If you, like, years down the line, you get a note and it's from your dead dad and it's really quite scathing indictment of who
you
are.
And it's actually because he'd come to see one of my shows and just didn't like it.
He'd written his own review, 2 stars.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, fuck. Who are you writing for Broadway Baby? What's going on?
That's the bind Steve Bennett's kids will be in one day. Inherit all of those 2-star reviews.
What's the have you thought about the most stressful situation that could be at your own funeral?
The most stressful situation?
Yeah, this is like, in my mind, I thought to myself, wouldn't it be so stressful if you were like you just maybe broken up with someone, or you were still seeing someone but like started dating someone else, or like there was like crossover or something like that.
Yeah.
And then you die in that little time, and then they both come to the funeral and that's how they find out. To me, I'm just like, how stressful, because like what's happening there is at your funeral people are just going like, oh he was a bit of a dirty dog.
You learn something new. I mean, a second family would be that'd be a nightmare. Huge, wouldn't it? Both fighting for the front couple of pews.
Yeah.
You'd have to leave instructions to plan 2 separate funerals.
I was going to say, you'd be attempting to plan 2, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah.
And you've got to be suspicious when someone's leaving really, really specific instructions for their funeral, not just like this song that wants to be played, but like this needs to be quite a long way away from where I live and for reasons that I'm not going to disclose. And also, please do burn that big vat of lube before the ceremony.
Well, presumably the lube's going in with the cremation.
It's got to be, right?
I would have thought really slippery bones. But then number 2, I don't know why, in my mind, they're one after the other. Because it's you still want the jeopardy, but you want to know you've controlled it.
Well, you'd have them both in the same venue.
Yeah, one after another. It's sort of a sitcom situation because they shouldn't know each other, should they? So, you know, presumably you've gone with a fake name for the second family. So,
yeah, I mean, it's basics. Basics are fun to watch, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so basic.
So long as there's no picture, unless with the second family, you went with a moustache all times. It's big.
But yeah, there might be a moment when the second family walk in and there's like three kids who look very similar to the three kids that are leaving.
Mm.
And there's just a moment of like, oh, could that be?
What the hell?
But you'd seem mad if you were leaving and you're like, I think dad might have had a second family and that might have been them coming in for the second funeral.
Ah, you're being crazy. You're stricken with grief.
Yeah, surely.
Wild to say that.
And then, but why are they re-digging the grave again? They seem to be winching the coffin back out and cleaning it. Something's not right here.
Something's not right.
Look at the name. Dad was John Gherkin. This guy was Bon Birkin. That's not a name. That's called Bon. It doesn't add up. None of it adds up.
That's a man panicking as he introduced himself in a pub, isn't it?
Bon Birkin.
Sticking with B for the surname, are you? Yes, Birkin it is. Bon Birkin. Absolutely.
BB.
Now, what's your relationship to events like their birthday, Father's Day, or any other significant events or things in that, you know, crop up?
It's a big question, and it's worthy of an episode all on its own just about anniversaries, I reckon. So maybe we'll have a look into that, because there are so many anniversaries around death, aren't there? But his birthday, as we're recording this, was last week or the week before, and it really just came and went as any other day for me. I have to say, I didn't even message like my stepmom being like, all right, or anything like this. I mean, like, you know, I don't know. I did when he died, on the anniversary of his death, but I mean, what do you do? It's just not that significant a day for me, really.
I think it depends on the person. I mean, my dad never made a big deal about birthdays and stuff. Weirdly, my dad's birthday is now my anniversary with my partner, which is sort of quite nice. I think
everything okay?
Yeah, everything's fine. Let's not read into that in any way. That just so happened to be a day where I felt like I needed to bring someone more officially into my life on a permanent basis.
So this is not the is this the anniversary of you meeting, or is this the anniversary? No, because it's I know the
sort of official. We're a couple now. But yeah, no, that was the moment when it happened, and I think I was conscious that it was my dad's birthday at the time, but it sort of felt quite nice. It was quite nice to have that day be important for a couple of reasons, because my girlfriend never met my dad. Obviously, he'd been dead for quite a long time before I met her. But it's sort of nice having those two celebrations on the same day, sort of in my head. It's not the reason that I did it, but it kind of brings them together, bonds them in a certain way. There's two different parts of my life, I think.
Did it almost feel a little bit like he was there with you?
Felt a bit like I was asking my dad out, yeah. It was nice.
There is that weird aspect where it's like when you're with a partner who hasn't met your dad,
yeah,
that does feel slightly unusual, where you're just like, could you not have put a bit more effort in?
Yeah, where were you?
What's going on here? I hadn't met you until 3 months ago, and he died 6 years ago. Yeah. Why weren't you putting a bit more effort in?
Is that the situation that you're in with your partner? Is she post dad?
Yeah. So she's recent, very recent. So there's nothing there. So yeah, she, in fact, her first probably encounter of like her of my dad was seeing my show.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that would have been probably her being, and maybe we had talked about it beforehand. I guess we probably would have in some way. But yeah, that would have been like the first time of hearing more in depth about it. Yeah.
You definitely still do assume when you meet someone kind of in the ballpark of our age that, you know, oh, that the dad's alive. So, you know, you are going to kind of, you must have, you know, cross that at some point, just simply as if to say, oh yeah, there's no, you don't have to bother about seeing this in-law due to dead.
It is an interesting thing to know, like, sort of when to bring it up as well, because actually the sort of the point you're making there of like it becomes so normal that you do some, you forget about like anniversaries, you forget about, you know, various things, and you talk about it in quite a casual way at times because it's so normal to you, which to some people suddenly is just like, what the fuck? Because their dad is very much alive and they're very, very close to them, and that it triggers, like, it's more triggering for them because it sparks these thoughts of like, fuck, my dad will be dead one day and I don't know how I'm going to deal with that.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that probably is a moment of realization that people have.
Mm.
I think I've almost got to the point now where I kind of forget that people have live dads.
Yeah, I think that's lame and embarrassing of them.
In many ways, yeah. Like, yeah. Particularly when you're in your 30s and you've still got a live dad.
Yeah, what are you playing
what
at?
What do you need him for? Can you not grow up yourself? Come on. That's playing on easy mode.
Yeah.
Although, one thing I found recently, I've started to find it annoying when people that I know lose a parent, because I sort of feel like it's my thing.
Oh, yeah. And as you're getting older, you're just like, oh, right, okay, I guess I'm not unique anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Jesus, give me a break. I was 30 when he died. And, you know, I'm going to turn 40 this year. And you're just like, come on, man.
Yeah.
Give me a break. Now everyone's dead. It's very en vogue.
It really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
That was the thing I found, because there is that, I think we touched on it earlier, there's sort of a trope to Edinburgh of people doing shows about their dead dad, which I didn't realise when I first started doing stand-up. And so obviously my first thought was, well, that's what I'll make my first show about. And then you learn about it and you're like, oh God, how is it now hack to have a dead dad?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the one thing that I've got. There is literally nothing else that's interesting about me. And now even that's not interesting.
It is remarkable though how like the whole the dead mum show is just so much rarer.
Yeah.
And what is it that leads to that? I'm sure there's a number of cultural and sort of like gendered based situations there, whether it be like you know, traditionally more difficult for women to get started in stand-up and to get a career, and whether or not there's like a gendered reason for like women to talk about a dead mum more, because it can't be that men have proportionally more dead dads than dead mums. Yeah. But maybe that is the case, and maybe the life expectancy of men is less, that definitely, maybe that leans into it. And
definitely is less, isn't it? Although I say definitely, this is something I learned in school, so I mean it might not be true anymore, but certainly when I was in school they said it was 7 years, wasn't it, the difference in
yeah, and my guess is that is not like you know, a man can expect to live to, you know, 74 and a woman can expect to live to 81. It's that men probably die in a higher number at a younger age, maybe, and that's what skews the statistics.
Just the sort of drinking and smoking culture that men tended to have in the 70s and 80s and 90s, obviously.
Yeah, really, and maybe it will start to even out now as
that's sort of,
you know, that stuff goes away.
Yeah, we don't have time to do that because everyone's working all the time now, so no one has time to do that sort of thing.
And the police stop you, you know, from drink driving these days. Like what is that? A nanny state sort of stuff. It's woke. It's very woke.
It is extremely woke, isn't it? But one of the things that sort of links to that from your show is, obviously, you mentioned that your dad was an alcoholic, and he taught you to flip beer mats as a kind of a way, I think you say, of like distracting you from the amount that he was drinking. Were you aware quite early on that it was potentially something that would shorten his life, I guess, or that was a problem?
I would say I had no idea until I was probably too old to sort of, for that to be acceptable to have only just worked out. I remember having a very clear moment when I would have been, I want to say, between the ages of 10 and 12, where it was getting to his birthday, which I've never entirely been sure what the date was, because like my nan was around the same time, so I always got the numbers confused about whether it was November 2nd or 5th or 7th. I couldn't quite ever work it out between the two of them. But it was said to my mum, what about if we get a bottle of wine for his birthday? I trying to work out, and it was just my brain went, he likes wine. He drinks a bottle of wine a night. Therefore, that's what we should get him.
Yeah.
And my mom was like, no. Just like shut it down, but did it in like a, you know, kind, you know, sensible way. But at the same time, it stuck in my brain of just like, that was a different response to what I expected to from the suggestion that I had come up with.
Mm.
And it just, it sat there as like a, I heard it recently. Is it from Into the Multiverse, a canon point? Was it a canon story or something? Where it's that moment in your life where you're like, there's that, the canonical moment. So right. In Spider-Man, it's that Uncle Ben has to die at some point for all of the Spider-Men. Now, I don't believe in that because it's obviously a film about an animated hero.
Yeah.
But it's funny sort of to be like, oh, there's a point where I first became aware that drinking too much or drinking regularly is not societally acceptable.
Right.
And that it's something that it shouldn't be. I shouldn't lean into that in any way.
So up until then, it was just sort of, that's what dads do.
That's it. You just come home, crack open the bottle of wine, have one of them, and then do it again the next day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because that's the only example that you have, isn't it, for how parents behave?
Yeah, and I know that it was like, it led to like questioning when I was a teenager and sort of, you know, I grew up not sort of very good public transport stuff. So if it was like round friends' houses, it would be a case of like the parents all negotiating who was doing pickups and drop-offs, and my parents would only ever push for like doing the drop-off, because basically that meant that my dad could do that if he wanted, but like anything beyond 8 o'clock he would have already drunk. So my mom was playing, you know, a game of trying to like hide that and to deal with that and deal with it and as sensibly and as like, you know, outwardly calmly as possible, which must be an incredibly stressful situation to be in. But I just do remember being like, my parents don't ever come and pick us up. And it means that other parents have the late night pickup, which must be more annoying.
Yeah.
Because also then it's like, you know, it's an 11 or a midnight pickup. And in your mind as a child, you're like, that is the latest anyone's ever been up. Whereas yeah. Now being like, oh, they're sort of probably about my age.
Yeah.
And the thought of being in bed before midnight is crazy. So I'd be like, if I was to be a parent, I'd be like, yeah, I'll come get you. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, that must have been very hard for your mum, because it's one of those cases of essentially trying to keep it together for somebody else because you know that they can't.
Yes, yeah, must be incredibly stressful. It must be so stressful for a lot of people out there dealing with that sort of situation. And again, yeah, not knowing who you can talk to about it, who is like able to support you in those situations. And that is, I guess, partly what the, you know, the show again, like that message of being able to talk about these things, whatever it is in your particular life, that is significant and it should be strived for. And I know it will be difficult for a lot of people, and there's so many reasons to not talk about things, but yeah, whether it's possible to achieve it, then do everything you can to achieve that.
Was it something he ever dealt with or tried to deal with, or was it just sort of an accepted fact of him?
There'd be times when he was on like the transplant list where it would be like, let's see how long he can, you know, you then had to be clean for a certain amount of time. Yeah. And blah, blah, blah. And there'd always be something that would eventually sort of rock that and it would kickstart again, sort of thing. And by the end, it was a case of he was so dependent on it that he couldn't be fully off of alcohol. So it would be just, you know, almost medically prescribed beer rather than wine or spirits to try and sort of make it more difficult to get as drunk and as poisoned as he was doing, but at the same time not giving him that full withdrawal that probably would have killed him anyway.
That's just something that I didn't realize for quite a long time about alcoholism, is that it is quite often the term for the withdrawal is often what kills people, isn't it? Because it's so sort of catastrophic in your body. I think I remember at school people talking about, was it Lemmy, the guy from Motorhead or something?
And there was Lemmy's the guy from Motorhead.
Yeah, and there was, I think it was him, that people at school would be like, oh, he's the ultimate rock star because he's actually prescribed, he has to drink Jack Daniels every day to stay alive. And everyone's like, oh, that's so cool. And then you sort of learn what that really means. You know, like, oh, that's maybe that's not as cool as I thought it was.
Is that real, what you've just said? Or is that sort of like where everyone in every school in the UK was like, oh man, did you hear Alice Cooper had a rib cage? He had a rib removed.
I'd heard Marilyn Manson, that one.
Yeah, I heard that one of Keenan and Kel died.
In 9/11. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the rumor that went around our school. Kel was killed in 9/11.
Yeah, because they hijacked the plane.
Kel hijacked the plane.
It's one of the later series, yeah.
That was a weird one, wasn't it? That was a weird episode. That's when they really were grasping
very orange soda based, but...
Yeah, yeah. Stormed the cockpit.
Well, it has been really lovely having you and sort of chatting about your dad, because I sort of always think whenever we go into these, like, oh, you know, we've surely now we've talked to enough people about dead dads where I'll be like, all right, I think I see what's coming next. Every time, every single time you start talking about, okay, well, it's crazy, isn't it? Everybody's got a completely different experience, even though we all have, there's similar bits. We go, oh, yeah, that's like me. So much what you're saying, I'm still like, oh man, that sucks. Fair enough.
Wait, hang on, what?
Never mind.
Is that how every I've been on a bunch of podcasts, they very rarely end with like, hey, thanks for coming on. Fucking sucks to be you.
But it sucks to be all of us. That's the thing, is it sucks to be all of us.
There we go. Stuart Laws. Fascinating man, very funny man. Do look him up. He's on tour. He's doing loads of really funny online stuff. He also has probably directed your favourite comedian's special, assuming your favourite comedian is James Acaster, which statistically it probably is. But he's a fantastic director of comedy and a very good writer and a very good comedian. So do check him out. One thing we should probably address is we went AWOL.
Yeah, we had
2 weeks off.
We had the Easter holidays.
As we've said before on this podcast, sometimes you're busy grieving.
Yeah, it does happen.
Grief sort of got in the way a little bit.
Yeah, grief bundled in on this one, gang. I would TW, but I'm not going to bury the lead. And I'm going to open by saying Flopsy is fine. My rabbit Flopsy is fine. That's the headline. But to get to that, we had to go through Flopsy is got cancer. Flopsy has not responding to the antibiotics. Flopsy is now having seizures. Flopsy is about to die. We had to go through that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're listening and you have a pet and if you've ever been through something like that where they have seizures, it really is just absolutely awful. It's just so awful. That you can't explain to them that it's fine. You're just watching them literally, in this case, spinning around, it's trying to make it funny, but it is miserable, absolutely miserable. I'm afraid I just didn't sleep for a very long time. I was sort of expecting, had to lie on the sofa because I was expecting him to die and I just wanted to be there when he did. It was absolutely awful. And then...
Dun, dun, dun.
Then... on Friday, last week, he started responding to the treatment. Suddenly, his seizures stopped and he started getting perkier. And to the extent that yesterday, at the time of recording, we took him to the vet. They did another ultrasound and his tumour has the mass that was growing from his tumour, which was pressing on his heart and was going to kill him, had shrunk significantly.
Oh, wow.
Significantly shrunk. Previously, they couldn't see his heart or his lung on the ultrasound. It was so big. Now they can see both. So that significantly shrunk. And he's put on weight, which is obviously, as we all know with cancer from this podcast, you lose weight when you have a tumour consuming it. He put on weight, which is another sign that he's getting better. So
it's looking good for Flopsy.
Yeah, he's not I don't think he's too keen on me having to give him daily penicillin injections. I'm not too keen on that either. It's not very fun. And the penicillin was getting stuck in the syringe, so it now has to be a larger syringe. So it's really not anyone's favourite thing.
How long will you have to keep injecting him with penicillin for?
Oh, another 3 weeks.
Okay.
Daily penicillin injections for another 3 weeks.
Oh, lovely stuff.
Subcutaneous into a scruff of the neck. Has to be the scruff of the neck. Because if it spills in his fur and he licks it, he will die.
It's not a perfect solution, but, I mean, it's the best we've got.
Yeah, it's not ideal. Also, when you inject it in, you don't just push it. You put it in. It's got negative pressure with how they draw it. So if you push it in, you pull the end of the syringe out, and it will return back to where it was.
Uh-huh.
That's the negative pressure. But if you pull it out and some blood comes out with it, that means you've hit an artery, and you have to take it out, rub the way you did it, make sure it stops bleeding, get rid of the blood from the syringe, then go again. That's because if you inject the penicillin into his artery, he will, of course, immediately die.
Right.
So we've got two very serious potential for death from syringing penicillin. So not great, but it is literally saving his life.
Every time you do it, it's like, I am saving his life, but I'm also, it's like 50-50, I'm going to kill him as well.
It is miserable. No, it is awful because the stress of that is you know, actually getting it in there to begin with. You feel it push through. It's awful. He flinches. It's miserable for him. And then you've got to take your time with the syringe in his body to pull it out to make sure you're not about to kill him like that.
Oh, man.
And then you've got to carefully withdraw it and press on the spot and rub it to make sure it doesn't spill. So it's no one's favourite time of day.
Yeah.
And that's in addition to Metacam twice a day and Panacure. So it's been miserable. But, guys, again, the headline is Flopsy lives. Touching word. Flopsy is fine and getting better. So about the being gone for 2 weeks, but I'm sure you would much rather I return and say, I'm back and my rabbit is fine, rather than me saying, my bunny, like my dad, has got cancer and died.
Yeah, did it bring back any dad memories? Did it feel a bit, because I don't know if we've discussed it on the podcast, but you've long had a theory that your rabbit is your dad reincarnated. Which, listen, I have an opinion on. I'm not gonna air that opinion now, but
well, you know, when you have a pet and you sort of talk to them and you sort of talk back like they're talking,
yeah,
and that kind of turns into a bit of a meme and a joke about what they'll say. One time I said, You're my perfect son, to which he replied, air quotes, no, I'm your dad, which just happened, and that kind of gag became consistent. At Christmas time, the song Feliz Navidad was very cleverly reworded into Flopsy is your dad. Yep. Flopsy is your dad. I know it's funny, but Flopsy Bunny is your dad. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, son. It fits perfectly.
Yeah.
But
the evidence is stacking up.
I think, perhaps tempting fate. To give him such a role. Cancer, I guess, at that point became inevitable.
Yeah, he took it a little bit too method.
He took it too far. I mean, it was very stressful in a way that losing my dad wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird thing to say, but dad's death was over a long period of time. And I don't know. I mean, I sometimes say on the podcast that it was quite tough watching him diminish, get mm-hmm. thinner, and then seeing him on a hospital bed at the end of his living room, not really able to respond so much, and having moments of being able to respond and not, isn't very nice as a vision.
No.
But were he spinning around on the bed in circles, having seizures, just rotating rapidly on the bed, that would have been much worse.
Yeah.
Much worse.
I can see that being quite upsetting.
Just spinning rapidly. The pace of the spins is so hard to describe.
Like something from The Exorcist.
Eyes fluttering. Just, oh my God. It's not like a human seizure. It's their inner ear, so it causes them to literally spin in circles. And then as they recover, their whole body is contorted, head bent around. It looks like they're going to break their backs or something.
Jesus.
It's really visually rough to watch. And then to think that's how they're going to die as well.
Actually, human seizure is quite beautiful. Of course. Quite a graceful thing to witness.
As the sun goes. It's a beautiful thing. Well, I mean, it is it's a more of a shake, which is at least not utterly demonic looking.
Yeah, I mean, if, as you said, if you saw your dad in a hospital bed
spinning,
pivoting at 60 miles an hour.
But then imagine recovering from a seizure, and the recovery is he completely bends forward and head kind of goes, rotates around, and he kind of does, makes this sort of, you know, Harry Potter way of a Cruciatus curse, whatever it is, the one that makes, if he did that, and that was how people recovered from seizures, you would be like, it's such a terrible thing to think that something that you care for, something you're basically meant to protect, is about to die, and was in a miserable way.
Mm.
And that's just awful. I mean, there's just no coming back from that. It just sucks.
Yeah.
So the fact that he didn't die in a miserable way was lovely. It's not my job to protect my dad, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a difference.
My
in
job
responsibility.
Isn't to keep him alive. If it was, I failed. I don't think it was. he was looking after that one himself. Whereas you are responsible for your pet.
And it would have been an unfair burden to put on you if your dad had cancer. The doctors were like, "You're going to sort this. Actually, we're going to send him home." And you're going to give him two treatments, both of which have quite a high probability that you will kill him. And then you'll be tried for manslaughter.
Yeah, you're doing the radiation. It is it is shocking. I also have a... just going to say a fact now.
Yeah.
I work for the BBC, so I can't be biased in any way, but I'm just going to say a fact. The fact that I'm going to say is that after a pet reaches a certain age, in this case, rabbit reaching 7 years of age, it is buried in the terms and conditions of our insurance provider that you then have to pay 20% of the treatment as well as the excess for the insurance payment.
Right.
So they will pay out only 80% of the cost after the excess paid after a pet reached a certain age, in this case 7 years for a rabbit. Not front and centre, that information. Buried quite deeply in the old terms and conditions.
Yeah, they do that.
That is a fact. And they cannot come after me because it's a fact. Though I won't name them, but I will say you can Google it.
Has your rabbit reached that age?
Yeah, he's 8.5.
Really?
So the £1,600 did not all come back.
Yes.
But the majority of it did.
How long do they normally live?
Well, I think 10 to 12 years is certainly possible with a house rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
I looked after well. You do see some on Reddit who live sort of 15 years, which is like, wow, but that's a outlier.
Yeah.
But 10 to 12 is possible with a bit of luck. So,
nice.
You know, obviously if they do get cancer, people do the same thing. But 7 years. 7 years is a bit of a, that's just a fact that I'm saying. And, you know, what I will say is obviously, you know, I'll keep with the insurance provider. There's no point changing because they did all the previous things with exclusions, but certainly won't be going with them next time. And if you're just to be aware of when you get a pet, look into that information, go with someone where that's not the case. That's my advice.
Very good advice.
Nothing unbiased there, that's all factual, so it's fine.
Yeah. Well, to conclude, very glad that your rabbit's fine.
And I've been shafted out of hundreds of pounds.
You've got a rabbit out of it. So
he's still alive, and I can give him lovely injections forever.
That's what everybody wants, of course.
I haven't got much of a social life.
Do you need one when you've got a rabbit?
No, when you've got a rabbit, you're fine. So thank you everyone for listening to me moan and complain. I do appreciate that. But I promise next week, back to humour from me, as everything goes well in my personal life, one assumes.
We reserve the right to just not do an episode because one of us is grieving. Like
always.
Fingers crossed we're here every week, but you'll understand, grief gets in the way every now and again.
Now we can put that on a t-shirt. That goes with Bottle It Up, doesn't
it? There we go. Bottle Up on the front, grief gets in the way every now and again on the back. On the inside, death comes for us all.
But it comes to you first.
Nice.